A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to talk about gout, specifically this relatively recent shift in how the medical community understands it. The old model was basically, you've got too much uric acid, it crystallizes in your joints, your toe swells up, end of story. But apparently that's not the full picture anymore. Gout is being reclassified as a systemic disease, a whole body condition. And he's asking two practical things. What are the options for continuous long-term treatment? And what do you do to taper down an acute flare when it's already happening? So where do we even start with this?
The uric acid part is still true, but it turns out it's almost the least interesting thing going on. The real story, and this has really only crystallized in the literature over the past 5 to 7 years, is that gout is fundamentally an inflammatory disease driven by the NLRP3 inflammasome. That's the protein complex inside immune cells that acts like a tripwire. When it detects monosodium urate crystals, it triggers the release of interleukin-1 beta, which is one of the most potent pro-inflammatory cytokines in the body.
The crystals aren't just mechanically irritating the joint like sand in a bearing. They're setting off an immune alarm system.
Exactly the right way to put it. And here's the thing. That alarm system doesn't just ring locally in the big toe. The systemic inflammation from repeated NLRP3 activation has been linked to a genuinely alarming list of comorbidities. There was a major cohort study out of the UK a couple of years ago that found gout patients have about a 40% higher risk of cardiovascular mortality independent of all the usual confounders. Independent of hypertension, independent of obesity, independent of diabetes. The uric acid itself isn't driving that, it's the chronic low-grade inflammation between flares.
Even when the joint isn't red and swollen, something is still smoldering.
That's the paradigm shift. The old thinking was, treat the flare, lower the uric acid, done. The new thinking is, you're managing a chronic inflammatory condition that happens to announce itself through joint pain. Between flares, these patients have elevated IL-1 beta, elevated CRP, endothelial dysfunction. The blood vessels are taking a hit even when the patient feels fine.
Which makes gout sound less like a rheumatological nuisance and more like a metabolic canary in the coal mine.
That's been the big reframing. Some researchers are now calling it a cardiometabolic disease with articular manifestations rather than a joint disease with metabolic associations. The direction of causality matters. There's a paper from the Framingham Heart Study cohort showing that gout independently predicts incident coronary heart disease, not the other way around. And it's not just the heart. Chronic kidney disease progression accelerates in gout patients. There's a bidirectional relationship with type 2 diabetes. There's even data linking gout to increased risk of atrial fibrillation.
When someone shows up with gout, the clinician should be thinking, this person's entire vascular system is under inflammatory siege, and the toe is just the part that hurts.
That's not how most gout is managed in primary care. The typical patient gets a flare, gets a short course of prednisone, or an NSAID maybe, gets told to avoid red meat and beer, and that's it. Maybe they get put on allopurinol if the flares keep coming back. But the treat-to-target approach that the American College of Rheumatology endorsed in their 2020 guideline and updated more recently is that you should be titrating urate-lowering therapy to get serum urate below 6 mg per deciliter and below 5 in patients with TOFI or more severe disease.
Below 5 is aggressive.
It is, and it's necessary because urate saturation in body fluids occurs at roughly 6.8 at body temperature. Below 6, existing crystals start to dissolve. Below 5, they dissolve faster. The goal isn't just preventing flares, it's eliminating the crystal burden entirely so the immune system stops getting triggered.
Let's walk through the continuous treatment landscape. Someone gets diagnosed. The doctor says we need to get your urate down and keep it down. What's the actual menu?
First line globally is still allopurinol, which is a xanthine oxidase inhibitor. It blocks the enzyme that converts hypoxanthine to xanthine and then xanthine to uric acid. It's cheap, it's been around since the 1960s, and it works well for most people. The key mistake, and this is where a lot of primary care goes wrong, is starting too high and titrating too fast. The 2020 ACR guideline says start at 100 milligrams a day or less, and in patients with chronic kidney disease, you start even lower, 50 milligrams. Then you titrate up every 2 to 4 weeks until you hit target.
Why start so low?
Because rapid urate lowering paradoxically triggers flares. When serum urate drops quickly, the surface of existing crystal deposits becomes unstable and sheds crystal fragments into the joint space, and the immune system goes haywire. It's one of the cruelest ironies in medicine. The treatment causes the very thing it's supposed to prevent, at least initially.
Like a hostage rescue that sets off a firefight.
That's not a bad analogy. So you start low, go slow, and crucially, you give flare prophylaxis for at least the first 3 to 6 months. That's usually low-dose colchicine or a daily NSAID-D. Colchicine at 0.6 mg once or twice daily is the preferred option. It works by inhibiting microtubule polymerization, which disrupts NLRP3 inflammasome assembly. It's actually quite elegant mechanistically. You're blocking the very pathway that causes the flare.
If allopurinol doesn't work or the patient can't tolerate it,
febuxostat is the next xanthine oxidase inhibitor in line. It's more potent and more selective than allopurinol, and it doesn't require dose adjustment in mild to moderate kidney disease, which is a real advantage given how many gout patients have renal impairment. For a while, there was a black box warning about cardiovascular risk based on the CARES trial, but the more recent FAST trial out of Europe largely put that to rest. The FDA has softened its stance. Febuxostat is a solid second-line option.
What about the people who can't tolerate either?
That's where the landscape gets interesting. We have pegloticase, which is a recombinant uricase enzyme. Uricase is the enzyme that most mammals have, but humans lost through evolution. It's why we have higher serum urate than other mammals. Pegloticase breaks uric acid down into allantoin, which is much more soluble and easily excreted. It's given as an intravenous infusion every 2 weeks, and it can drop serum urate to near zero within hours.
Near zero sounds almost too good.
It is, and it isn't. The problem is immunogenicity. About 40% of patients develop anti-drug antibodies that neutralize the enzyme, and then it stops working. There are now co-administration strategies with immunomodulators, methotrexate or mycophenolate, that improve the durability of response, and there's a newer pegylated uricase in trials that may have lower immunogenicity. But pegloticase is reserved for severe refractory gout, the kind where people have visible tophi and joint destruction despite oral therapy.
The escalation ladder is allopurinol, febuxostat, and then the intravenous heavy artillery. What about the drugs that don't lower urate, but block the inflammatory pathway directly?
This is where the systemic disease understanding has opened up entirely new treatment avenues. If gout is an NLRP3 inflammasome disease driven by IL-1 beta, then why not block IL-1 beta directly? And we now have drugs that do exactly that. Canakinumab is a monoclonal antibody against IL-1 beta. It's approved for gout flares in Europe, but not in the US for gout specifically, though it's used off-label. Anakinra is an IL-1 receptor antagonist, shorter half-life, daily injection, also effective for flares. These are especially useful in hospitalized patients who can't take NSAIDs because of kidney injury or colchicine because of drug interactions.
For continuous treatment, is anyone using IL-1 blockade chronically for gout?
Not routinely, and not first line. The cost is enormous, and the infection risk is non-trivial. But for patients with frequent flares despite optimized urate-lowering therapy, or those with chronic tophaceous gout that isn't responding, it's an option. There are also small molecule NLRP3 inhibitors in development, oral drugs that would block the inflammasome directly without the immunosuppressive baggage of biologics. That's probably the next big thing in gout therapeutics. A few are in phase 2 trials.
The pipeline is moving from managing uric acid to managing the immune response to uric acid.
That's the direct consequence of understanding gout as a systemic inflammatory disease rather than a crystal deposition problem. The crystals are the spark, but the fire is immunological, and the fire damage extends far beyond the joint.
Let me pivot to the second part of the prompt, which is what you do when someone is already in a flare. The ship is on fire. What actually works to put it out?
The three pillars of acute flare management are NSAIDs, colchicine, and corticosteroids. And the single most important principle, which sounds obvious but is routinely violated in practice, is that you need to start treatment within the first 12 to 24 hours of symptom onset. The inflammasome cascade amplifies itself. IL-1 beta triggers more IL-1 beta release. The earlier you interrupt that, the shorter and milder the flare.
Waiting it out is the worst strategy.
It guarantees a longer, more severe episode. Now, among the three options, the choice depends on the patient's comorbidities. For an otherwise healthy person, a potent NSAID at full anti-inflammatory dosing is often the fastest route. Naproxen, 500 mg twice daily, or indomethacin, 50 mg, 3 times daily, though indomethacin has fallen out of favor a bit because of more GI and CNS side effects. The key is that you need anti-inflammatory doses, not analgesic doses. Someone popping one ibuprofen is not treating the flare.
What's the duration? Do you stop when the pain stops?
You continue at full dose until the flare is fully resolved, which usually means 24 to 48 hours after the pain and swelling are completely gone, and then you stop. These are short courses. For NSAIDs, we're typically talking 3 to 7 days. You don't taper NSAIDs, you just stop them. Colchicine for acute flares has a narrow therapeutic window. The traditional regimen, take 2 tablets, then 1 every hour until relief or diarrhea, is now considered obsolete and borderline dangerous. The modern approach, validated in randomized trials, is to take 1.2 mg at the first sign of a flare, followed by 0.6 mg 1 hour later, and then 0.6 mg once or twice daily for the next couple of days. That's it. The high-dose old-school regimen causes toxicity without meaningfully better efficacy.
Colchicine toxicity is no joke.
It's terrifying. Multi-organ failure, rhabdomyolysis, bone marrow suppression. And it's even riskier in patients taking CYP3A4 inhibitors like clarithromycin or certain antifungals or P-glycoprotein inhibitors. Colchicine is metabolized by CYP3A4 and transported by PGP. Block either of those pathways and colchicine levels can skyrocket. There have been fatal interactions with clarithromycin specifically. So the modern dosing reflects a hard-won respect for the drug's toxicity.
The third pillar, steroids.
Corticosteroids are incredibly effective for acute gout, and they're underutilized in primary care. Prednisone, 30 to 40 mg daily for 3 to 5 days, is a standard regimen. Some clinicians taper, but for a short 3 to 5 day course, tapering isn't strictly necessary. The HPA axis recovers fine. For monoarticular flares, an intraarticular steroid injection can be magical. A single injection of triamcinolone into the affected joint often resolves the flare within 24 hours, and it avoids all the systemic side effects.
Do you need to confirm the diagnosis before injecting? Because a septic joint can look a lot like gout.
That's the crucial caution. You should aspirate the joint and send the fluid for cell count, Gram stain, culture, and crystal analysis before injecting steroids. If there's any doubt, you hold the steroids and treat empirically for infection until cultures come back. Injecting steroids into a septic joint is a catastrophe. The infection smolders, the joint gets destroyed, and the steroids mask the fever and systemic signs. It's one of those clinical scenarios where the right move is to be paranoid.
For the acute flare, the algorithm is: start fast, pick the right drug for the patient's kidney function and comorbidity profile, treat until resolution plus a day or two, and don't taper NSAIDs. For steroids, you can taper or not, depending on duration.
The other thing that doesn't get said enough, during an acute flare, you do not stop urate-lowering therapy. If the patient is already on allopurinol or febuxostat, they keep taking it. Stopping causes urate levels to fluctuate, which prolongs the flare. This used to be a common teaching error: stop allopurinol during a flare, and it's been definitively refuted.
That's a persistent myth in medicine, isn't it? The idea that you should hold the allopurinol.
It's one of those things that got passed down through generations of trainees without ever being tested. Then someone actually studied it, and surprise! Continuing allopurinol during a flare doesn't worsen outcomes, and stopping it makes things worse. The ACR guideline now explicitly says, continue urate-lowering therapy during acute flares.
Let's talk about the dietary and lifestyle piece, because that's where most patient conversations start and where a lot of the pop science misinformation lives.
The purine-rich food avoidance list, red meat, organ meats, shellfish, beer, has some basis in physiology, but it's been wildly overstated. Dietary purines account for only about a third of the body's urate pool. The rest is endogenous production. So even a perfectly purine-free diet would only drop serum urate by about 1 mg per deciliter, maybe 1.5. That's not nothing, but it's rarely enough to get someone below target.
The person who gives up steak and beer and still gets flares isn't failing at lifestyle modification. The lifestyle modification was never going to be sufficient.
Correct, and there's a real harm in the moralizing around gout. Patients get told, implicitly or explicitly, that they brought this on themselves through dietary indiscretion. It's a disease that carries stigma, the disease of kings, rich food, excess. But the strongest risk factor for gout is genetics, not diet. Variants in urate transporter genes like SLC2A9 and ABCG2 explain a huge portion of the variance in serum urate. Some people are just exquisitely efficient at reabsorbing urate in the kidney.
It's less Henry VIII and more your great-grandparents' kidney transporters.
Yet the dietary conversation still dominates. What the evidence actually supports is less about individual purine-rich foods and more about overall metabolic health. Weight loss reduces serum urate. The DASH diet, which is the dietary approaches to stop hypertension diet, lowers serum urate. Fructose is a genuine concern because fructose metabolism in the liver consumes ATP and generates uric acid as a byproduct. Sugar-sweetened beverages are more strongly associated with gout than most purine-rich foods.
If you're going to give someone three dietary priorities for gout, what are they?
1. Eliminate sugar-sweetened beverages, especially those with high fructose corn syrup. 2. Limit alcohol. Beer is the worst offender, then spirits, wine is relatively neutral in moderation. 3. Follow a dietary pattern that promotes weight loss if the patient is overweight, because adipose tissue is itself a source of inflammatory cytokines that worsen the systemic inflammation piece. That's it. The old school, avoid organ meats and asparagus. Advice is a footnote.
I want to go back to something you mentioned about the comorbidities, because I think this is where the systemic disease reclassification really lands with practical force. If gout is independently predicting heart attacks and kidney failure, what should a primary care doctor actually do differently when a gout patient walks in?
The checklist should expand. A gout diagnosis should trigger aggressive cardiovascular risk factor screening and management. Check a lipid panel, check an A1C, check renal function, check blood pressure, and treat those things to target, not just casually. Some rheumatologists are now arguing that gout should be considered a cardiovascular risk enhancer in the same way that chronic inflammatory conditions like rheumatoid arthritis and psoriasis are. The American Heart Association and American College of Cardiology already count those as risk enhancers in their risk calculator. Gout isn't formally on that list yet, but the data is pushing hard in that direction.
Which would change statin prescribing thresholds for millions of people.
If you're a 45-year-old with gout and a borderline LDL, the current calculator might say you don't quite meet the threshold for a statin. Add gout as a risk enhancer, and suddenly you do. Given what we know about endothelial dysfunction and vascular inflammation in gout, that's probably the right call.
There's also the kidney piece. You mentioned the bidirectional relationship with chronic kidney disease.
This is where the therapeutic decisions get complicated, because many gout patients already have some degree of renal impairment, and that limits your drug choices. NSAIDs are relatively contraindicated in CKD. Colchicine needs dose reduction. Allopurinol needs a lower starting dose. But here's the counterintuitive part. Adequately treating gout with urate-lowering therapy may actually slow CKD progression. There are observational studies suggesting that patients who achieve target urate levels have a slower decline in eGFR than those who don't. The inflammation from gout may be contributing to renal injury, and by suppressing that inflammation through urate lowering, you're protecting the kidneys.
It's not just that kidney disease makes gout harder to treat. Gout makes kidney disease worse.
That's the systemic disease concept in a nutshell. The joint is the most visible battlefield, but the war is being fought in the vascular endothelium, the renal tubules, the cardiac muscle. Every flare is a systemic inflammatory event. The goal of treatment isn't just a comfortable toe. It's reducing the total inflammatory burden over decades.
What about Tofi? I feel like we haven't talked about what happens when gout is untreated or undertreated for years.
Tofi are deposits of monosodium urate crystals surrounded by a chronic granulomatous inflammatory reaction. They can form in joints, in bursae, in tendons, even in the helix of the ear. They're not just cosmetic, they cause erosive joint damage. The chronic inflammation eats into bone and cartilage. I've seen hand x-rays where the joints look like they've been gnawed on by an animal.
That's a vivid image.
It's an accurate one. And Tofi can form in places you wouldn't expect. There are case reports of Tofi in the spine causing cord compression, in the carpal tunnel causing median neuropathy, in the vocal cords causing hoarseness. Once Tofi are present, the treatment target gets more aggressive, serum urate below 5 mg per deciliter, and the timeline to resolution is measured in months to years, not weeks. With sustained urate lowering, Tofi do resolve. The crystals dissolve, the inflammatory tissue remodels, and the mass shrinks. But it requires patience and adherence.
Adherence is a known problem with gout treatment.
It's one of the worst in chronic disease management. Studies show that fewer than half of gout patients are still taking their urate-lowering therapy after a year. Part of it is that gout is intermittent. You feel fine between flares, so the motivation to take a daily pill fades. Part of it is the flare paradox we talked about. Starting allopurinol can trigger flares, so the patient associates the treatment with making things worse. And part of it is that primary care doesn't always explain the long game clearly. If the patient thinks allopurinol is a painkiller, they'll take it when their toe hurts and stop when it doesn't. That's a failure of communication.
The educational piece is almost as important as the pharmacological one.
It's essential. Patients need to understand. This is a chronic disease. The medication is preventive. Flares in the first few months of treatment are a sign that the crystals are mobilizing, not that the drug isn't working, and staying on therapy for years will eventually eliminate flares entirely. That's a hard sell to someone who's currently in pain and just wants it to stop.
The people who can't take oral medications, or who have such severe disease that nothing else works, what's the end of the road look like?
Pegloticase is the current last resort for refractory disease, and it works dramatically when it works. I've seen before and after photos of hands with massive tophi that essentially disappeared over 6 to 12 months of pegloticase therapy. It's remarkable. The catch, as I mentioned, is the immunogenicity problem. About 40% of patients develop anti-drug antibodies. The co-administration of methotrexate, typically 15 mg weekly, has been shown to reduce antibody formation and improve the durability of response. Some centers are now using mycophenolate, mofetil, for the same purpose.
What about surgery? Do people still get tophi surgically removed?
They do, but it's fallen out of favor as a primary strategy. Surgical debulking of tophi can provide immediate mechanical relief, especially if a tophus is compressing a nerve or limiting joint function. But it doesn't address the underlying metabolic problem, and tophi often recur if urate isn't controlled. The modern approach is to use surgery as an adjunct to aggressive urate lowering, not a replacement for it.
To synthesize the continuous treatment piece for someone who's just been diagnosed, you start allopurinol low and slow. You protect them with colchicine, or an NSAID for the first 3 to 6 months. You titrate the allopurinol until serum urate is below 6, or below 5 if they're a tophi, and you keep them there for life. If allopurinol isn't tolerated, you switch to febuxostat. If oral therapy fails, you escalate to pegloticase. And throughout, you're screening for and aggressively managing cardiovascular risk factors.
That's the algorithm. And I'd add one thing that often gets missed, you recheck serum urate regularly, not once a year. The ACR guideline says every 2 to 4 weeks during titration, and then every 6 months once the target is achieved. Urate levels drift. Kidney function changes. The dose that worked 2 years ago may not be sufficient today.
For the flare itself, start treatment within the first 24 hours. Pick NSAIDs or colchicine or steroids based on the patient's kidney function and comorbidities. Treat through to resolution plus a day or two, and don't stop the urate-lowering therapy. If it's a single joint and you can aspirate to rule out infection, an intra-articular steroid injection is probably the fastest route to relief.
One nuance on the steroid injection, it's not just triamcinolone. Methylprednisolone and betamethasone are also used. The choice depends on the joint size and the clinician's preference. A large joint like the knee might get 40 to 80 milligrams of methylprednisolone equivalent. A small joint like the first MTP gets less. And you want to make sure the needle is actually in the joint space. Extra-articular injection doesn't work and can cause soft tissue atrophy.
I'm struck by how much of good gout management comes down to patience and communication. The pharmacology is relatively straightforward. The challenge is getting someone to stick with a treatment that might make them feel worse before it makes them feel better.
That's the art of it. And it's why the systemic disease framing is so important therapeutically. If the patient understands that this isn't just about their toe, that it's about their heart, their kidneys, their long-term health, the daily pill becomes a lot more meaningful. You're not just preventing flares. You're preventing heart attacks 20 years from now.
It reframes gout from an episodic nuisance to a chronic disease deserving of chronic treatment.
That's exactly the shift that rheumatology has been trying to communicate to primary care for the past decade. The 2020 ACR guideline was a landmark document, but it's only as good as its implementation. Most gout is managed in primary care by clinicians who aren't rheumatologists and who may not have internalized the systemic disease concept. There's a big implementation gap.
Is there anything on the horizon that might close that gap? New drugs, new delivery methods?
The small molecule NLRP3 inhibitors I mentioned are the most exciting thing in the pipeline. If one of those makes it through phase 3 trials, you'd have an oral drug that blocks the inflammasome directly, potentially both for flare treatment and for chronic suppression. That would be a paradigm shift comparable to what biologics did for rheumatoid arthritis. There's also work on urate, lowering therapies with better safety profiles. Toporoxostat is a newer xanthine oxidase inhibitor approved in Japan that may have less cardiovascular risk than febuxostat. And there are drugs targeting URAT1, the urate transporter in the kidney, that increase urate excretion. Lesinurad was the first, but it had renal toxicity concerns and was withdrawn in some markets. Newer URAT1 inhibitors are in development with better selectivity.
The pipeline is active. It's not a stagnant therapeutic area.
Far from it. Gout is one of the most common inflammatory diseases in the world. Prevalence is somewhere around 4% of adults in the U.S., higher in older men, and it's been undertreated for decades. The market opportunity is enormous, and the science is finally catching up to the clinical need.
One last thing I want to touch on. You mentioned genetics earlier. What does the heritability actually look like?
Twin studies suggest heritability of serum urate is around 60 to 70%. The ABCG2 gene variant alone, that's the gene encoding a urate transporter in the gut and kidney, accounts for a significant fraction of gout risk. People with certain ABCG2 variants have reduced urate excretion capacity, so they accumulate urate even on a normal diet. There's a fascinating evolutionary angle here. Humans lost the uricase enzyme somewhere in the Miocene, and the resulting higher urate levels may have been advantageous. Uric acid is a powerful antioxidant, and some researchers think it helped our ancestors maintain blood pressure in low salt environments. But in the modern dietary context, that evolutionary legacy becomes a liability.
Gout is partly a mismatched disease. Our physiology evolved in one environment, and we're living in another.
High fructose diets, abundant purines, longer lifespans, higher rates of obesity and kidney disease. All of these amplify a genetic predisposition that might have been silent in a different context. Gout is an ancient disease described by Hippocrates, but its modern epidemiology is very much a product of the 21st century.
This has been illuminating. I went into this thinking of gout as a straightforward crystal problem, and it turns out it's an immunological fire that happens to announce itself through joint pain.
That's the one-sentence summary. Gout is a systemic autoinflammatory disease driven by the NLRP3 inflammasome, and the uric acid crystals are the trigger, not the disease itself. Treat the inflammation, lower the urate, protect the heart and kidneys, and communicate the long game clearly to the patient.
If you're in a flare right now, don't wait. Start treatment today.
Within 12 hours if you can. The inflammasome doesn't self-limit quickly.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The common octopus hears not through ears, but through the statocyst, a fluid-filled sac lined with sensory hairs and a mineralized statolith that vibrates in response to sound waves, essentially an acoustic accelerometer. In the 1720s, sailors off the coast of Equatorial Guinea reported octopuses apparently responding to ship bells at depths where light barely penetrates, a phenomenon that made no sense until the statocyst's acoustic sensitivity was formally described 2 centuries later.
An acoustic accelerometer. In an octopus.
2 centuries to catch up to what sailors already knew. Sounds about right.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.